President of the United States, William Jefferson Clinton.
Morning, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to the second day. I hope you enjoyed yourselves yesterday. I want to get I want to get right into the program. We have a very distinguished panel, and I don't want to take any of their time, but we're going to announce a few commitments to begin. The first involves a very interesting group, and I'd like to ask them to come out. One of this morning's panelists, a person I have a vague and passing acquaintance with, Tony Blair. Wendy Kopp, the founder and CEO of Teach for America. Brett Vigdoritz, the founder and CEO of Teach First in the UK. Barun Mohanty, the director of the Michael and Susan Dell Foundation, and Amy Robbins, the executive director of the Amy and Larry Robbins Foundation. The commitment is as follows. In partnership with Teach First, its British counterpart, Teach for America will launch Teach for All, expanding its education model internationally over the next 3 years, focusing on eradicating the educational disparities that exist in high-poverty communities. Through Teach for All, top college graduates will be placed in schools initially to focus on seven nations, including Estonia, Germany, India, Israel, and South Africa. The Michael and Susan Dell Foundation is already committed to a $2.5 million grant for the program in India. Amy Robbins has pledged $2 million for the program. This past year, 18,000 young people in the United States competed to enter Teach for America, including between 5 and 10% of the seniors at 90 colleges and universities from Princeton, Harvard, and Yale to some of our country's most prestigious historically black colleges and university. Teach for America now has 5,000 members in schools across the country, and Teach First is catching on in the UK. These people have done amazing, amazing work, and I am very excited that they're going to expand their operations in other countries. The value of this commitment over 3 years will be $25 million. Let's give them a big hand. This is great. I do want to say, I was told I wasn't supposed to do that, but I got permission from Tony. His son, Nick, is in Teach for All in the UK, teaching in Birmingham today. So they're putting their family where their speeches are, and I thank you. Thank you all very much. Let's give them a big hand. I'm not sure I've got this in the right order, but I'm going to do it this way anyway. The next person I'd like to invite to the stage is Prince Albert of Monaco, the former president of Ireland, Mary Robinson, President Ricardo Lagos, the former president of Chile, Gro Harlem Brundtland, former prime minister of Norway and distinguished WHO, former director, Mohammed El-Asri, senior fellow at the United Nations Foundation, and Ted Turner, the founder of the UN Foundation. He's a pretty good group this morning, aren't they? Your man. The organizations involved include Monaco, the UN Foundation, and the Club of Madrid, which is a group of those of us who used to be in office and want to find some continuing way to have an impact in a positive way on global affairs. Their commitment is to work with international leaders to develop an agreed-upon framework for an international climate change treaty to follow Kyoto. This is a very important thing. All of you heard Al Gore talking about this yesterday and the importance of having a new post-Kyoto international agreement. The UN Foundation and the Club of Madrid jointly launched the Global Leadership for Climate Action Task Force, comprised of former heads of state and government, committed to work together on the next round of international climate negotiations. With crucial support from Prince Albert, recognizing that a global agreement is urgently needed, they are going to try to find a way to do something that will have broader support and bring in the United States, and also be capable of actually being implemented in a way that we understand. In June, the G8 nations agreed to work to at least half their CO2 emissions by 2050. Earlier this month at Gleneagles, the leaders there endorsed the Global Leadership for Climate Action Framework to help them meet their objectives. The need for this commitment is clear. As of June the 6th, 174 nations and the EEC had ratified Kyoto, and a great deal has been done, even though most of the countries that ratified Kyoto will not meet their Kyoto targets. 36 countries are on track to meet their reductions by 2012. The UK and Sweden are on pace to meet their goals by 2010. And as you may remember from our first panel yesterday, the nations that are doing so actually are having better economic performance, more evenly spread in their societies than those that are not. So this is a very important commitment that I think will produce very important environmental progress and economic advances for every country that plays a part in it. I want to thank the leaders here. Mary Robinson, Gro Brundtland, and Ricardo Lagos are all friends of mine, popular in their own countries for the extraordinary contributions that they made in their leadership positions, and three people who proved that you can be good for the environment and good for the economy. And of course, without Ted Turner, there never would have been a UN Foundation, and there never would have been what we now have, which is an incredible partnership between the world's most important international organization and the private sector. So we thank him and give them all a big hand. Now, I would like to invite Peter Sands, the CEO of Standard Chartered Bank, to the stage. Thank you. Standard Chartered Bank will develop lending and advisory capabilities for renewal and clean energy projects in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. This is another thing we talked about yesterday, trying to make sure that the commitments in this area were economically beneficial and involved people well beyond the most developed nations. It is estimated that in the end, increasing the capacity of countries to put together these packages will lead to financings in the neighborhood of 4 to 5 billion dollars. Over the next 5 years, Standard Chartered Bank will commit to underwrite that much in debt to renewable energy projects, and over the total life of this project, to underwrite $8 to $10 billion, targeting clean energy in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, focusing on wind, hydro, geothermal, solar, biomass, coal bed, methane. Standard Charter's financial expertise will allow these projects to access capital effectively and expand the emerging market. Last year, over $100 billion in new money was invested in green and clean energy projects, $20 billion more than in the two previous years. But still, 60% of the world's ecosystems are in decline, and compared to the need, this area is underfinanced and underorganized. Renewable resources produce only about 2% of the world's energy, but they do account for 18% of the world's investment now, new investment in power generation. However, 70% of the money has been invested in the U.S. and the EU, only 20% of the total invested in developing nations. Standard Charter is going to change that. And Peter Sands, I thank you very much. It's amazing how much difference a relatively small amount of money can make in this area. Earlier this year, sort of along this line, we had a conference in New York that Mayor Bloomberg and Mayor Livingstone from London hosted with our foundation, with the 40 cities from five continents that are in our partnership to reduce climate change. And we had five banks commit $5 billion to rapid retrofitting of existing facilities. And I was shocked to learn that that doubled the amount of money being spent in the entire world on building retrofits in urban areas. We have just scratched the surface of what we can do, and we can't do anything without financing. I predict that this commitment by Standard Chartered will not only result in a dramatic reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, but an extraordinary explosion of new sectors of economic development in the developing world, now in all three, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. So we should give him a big hand and hope a lot of people want to do the same thing. Thank you very much. Now, I would, before I present the next commitment, I want to recognize the contributions of the Gilman Foundation to the work of the Global Initiative. The Gilman Foundation was spearheaded in my first encounter with it by the late Howard Gilman, who was a timber executive and philanthropist from here in New York. They had a lot of timber in Florida, among other places, and they have a wonderful retreat there called White Oak Plantation. It's been there for decades. They have made it available to us as a planning retreat for CGI, and it's already produced some results, as you'll see in a moment. After one of our meetings at White Oak, Jim Rogers, president and CEO of Duke Energy, reached out to other utilities that are leaders in energy efficiency and asked them to join an ambitious effort, which I'll describe in a moment. But I'd like to ask the board and the officers of the Gilman Foundation, if they're here, to stand up, and we should give them a big hand because they helped us to do what we're doing today. Thank you all. There they are, right there. Now I'd like to ask Jim Rogers, the president and CEO of Duke Energy, Jeff Sterba, the CEO of PNM Resources, Kevin Burke, the president and CEO of Con Ed, Mike Chesser, the chairman and CEO of Great Plains Energy, Tom Kuhn, the president and CEO of Edison Electric Institute, and Dennis Racy, the chairman, president and CEO of Pepco Holdings, to come up here. And if I've left anybody else, let me know, because I know in addition to the companies I mentioned, Sierra Pacific Resources and XL Energy are involved in this project. They are committing significant investments to energy efficiency, the creation of an Institute for Electricity and Efficiency, and a commitment to work with stakeholders to see substantially greater increases in energy efficiency over the long run than can be achieved based on what we know now. Let me put some meat on those bones. 8 U.S. electric companies serving nearly 20 million customers in 22 states joined together today in a commitment to help make America the most energy efficient economy in the world. Remember what I said yesterday. Goldman Sachs has a study that says if the United States, China, India, and Russia were to reach Japan's levels of energy efficiency alone with not one new watt of clean energy at all, it would reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 20% across the globe. This is the commitment these people are making for the United States. They represent companies of different sizes in different markets with different regulatory structures. But they all agree that energy efficiency is the greatest untapped resource in addressing global climate change in the near term. It is the low-hanging fruit. Today, they pledge to make this a priority in an organized way. Over the next 10 years, they will invest significant resources in efficiency measures, working with policymakers and others to overcome regulatory battles that discourage such investments. With the right regulatory reforms, they pledge to increase their collective investment by $500 million a year to over $1.5 billion a year. Once implemented, this commitment will eliminate 30 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions a year, the equivalent of taking 6 million cars off the road. With Edison Electric, the companies will also create an Institute for Electric Efficiency, enabling them to share and promote best practices. Now, the United States and China are the world's two top greenhouse gas emitters, and we are the biggest at 25%. The burning of coal, oil, and natural gas cause about 80% of all CO2 emissions in the world. In the United States, it's a little more balanced because about a third of our emissions come from transportation, but the rest is due to these other factors. This language is sort of anodyne because not all these companies have committed to do the same thing in the same way. So I'm going to try to explain it to you in my basic English. Here's the way you pay your electric bill in America. You go, the electric company gets permission to charge a certain rate per kilowatt hour. So the more you use, the more you pay. And this is the way it is everywhere. Only California today has the power to disconnect how much you pay from how much you use. The significant thing is you could pay a little more per kilowatt hour and pay over time for investments in energy efficiency. They've been working on this for 32 years. As a result, in California, our largest state, the per capita energy consumption is only 55% of the national average. Mr. Rogers' idea is to have all utilities have the option and eventually the responsibility to tell every homeowner and every business owner in the United States that they have a right, not just to electricity, but to the most energy efficient electricity available. And this is not a user-friendly practice. I think I said something about this yesterday. It's not the easiest thing in the world to go out and figure out how to maximally insulate your home and what's the most cost-effective thing to do. If the utilities do this, then they can put together a plan, go find all the contractors, get all the materials, and in effect pay for the cost on your home or in your office building as if they were building a mini power plant there. That is, instead of financing it like a consumer loan for 1 year or a car loan for three, it could be financed over a 20-year period or longer. The consumer then would have to pay a little more per kilowatt hour, but never so much that they wouldn't still have lower total utility bills because they'd be using so much less. So suppose they make your home 30% more efficient. They charge you 15% more per kilowatt hour. So your bill goes down 15% and they get the financing they need. Collectively, it will be much less expensive for them than building a new power plant. They'll be able to finance both, and we won't be contributing any more to climate change. This is a simple, brilliant idea. But we have to, and so it has the capacity to fundamentally transform what we have been doing in America. As I said, in theory, almost everything we need to do is economical. In practice, we are underorganized and undercapitalized, and we don't have enough consumer knowledge to maximize the opportunities that the market presents us. This is an unbelievable commitment these people are making. And you're talking about, I think, tens of billions of dollars. I think that they have been modest about how much greenhouse gases will go down. And I think if we can get everybody everywhere in the world to adopt this sort of system, then every place there's electricity, we ought to say there should be a right to the most efficient electricity, and all regulatory systems should be organized around it, because the electric companies are in the best position to know how to do the energy audits, and then they would be the focal point for finding all the contractors, the people that supply the most efficient windows, and you name it. This is a huge potential deal. This could reorganize the way every advanced economy and many middle-income countries approach the challenge of climate change and prove that there are immediate, persistent, significant economic benefits in doing the right thing by our children and our grandchildren's future. So we owe these people a lot. This has the potential to fundamentally change the nature of this debate in a way that will prove its great economics and possible to effectively reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Let's give them a big hand. Let's give them another hand. They may just have saved you a fortune. If you want to jumpstart this process, by the way, and you're an American, remember, I will say again, there are, I think, 11 states, Mr. McLarty would know this better than me, I think there are 11 states which have decoupled natural gas charges from natural gas usage, but only California has done this for electricity. We have to do this everywhere in America. Then the utilities can become the drivers of maximum energy efficiency. And if you are a non-American and you come from a country where everybody's got electricity, when you get home, you ought to check and see how the laws affect the way people charge for it and what options there are in your country for people to actually share the cost with the local utility of financing efficiency, so that you have a win-win. The utility doesn't lose money, but the ratepayer saves money. This is a good deal. Let's go on with the panel. Thank you very much, and good morning.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists. Prime Minister of the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, Meles Zenawi. Secretary of the United States Treasury, Hank M. Paulson. Former Prime Minister of Norway and United Nations Special Envoy on Climate Change, Dr. Gro Harlem Brundtland. Former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Tony Blair. And our moderator, NBC News special correspondent, Tom Brokaw.
Thank you all very much. The president obviously put this all in the appropriate context, and I think that it's hard to believe that in this room there's no one who is not aware of the now universal consensus in the scientific community and in the political community about the reality of global warming. In New York, we're acutely aware of it this week as the Mets begin to melt down in the National League playoff race. And we also have, with all due respect to the heads of state who are here, we have some ideas for how we can deal with the emissions from the security entourages that visit New York every year at this time and jam up traffic. We're going to issue every head of state who comes for the General Assembly a Metro card so that they can ride the subway and give us the opportunity to get from home to work in something under 5 hours in Midtown, New York. We're going to get right on with the panel because we have a very full day. I want to begin with Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, someone I know well. We have a lot of shared interests. I know that Hank and Wendy are ardent conservationists. I've been on birdwatching expeditions with them that are also marathons. It's a death march from about 4 in the morning until just after midnight. So, Hank, you find yourself now in an administration that most environmentalists find hostile to their cause. The president wants to have a meeting today and tomorrow of the industrialized nations, but already the German environmental minister says nothing will happen at that meeting. We're going to wait until we get to Bali. Is the president effectively going to be a lame duck when it comes to global warming for the next year and a half when a lot of critical decisions will be made, as the rest of the world appears to be waiting for a new administration?
Well, okay, Tom.
keeping in mind, we are friends.
And he said he was my friend. let me begin by saying I think there are a fair number of myths or misperception. For instance, there's a major myth, which is the U.S. is lagging well behind other developed nations in dealing with the carbon emissions challenge. We've got a lot to do. There's a lot the rest of the world's got to do. But I just was looking at numbers for the last year. We grew 2.9%. Our emissions were reduced 1.3%. I think overall we compare well with the rest of the world based upon the big investments in technology. I think there's another myth, which is the president isn't taking global warming seriously. He's taking it very seriously. I don't see how it could be anything other than a positive. And I believe Prime Minister Blair will agree to get the major economies of the world, to get the nations that are responsible for 80% of the carbon emissions and to get them together to deal with a global problem. And I think the success that we can achieve working together is just going to be critical to the overall result the United Nations needs to achieve. And I am really hopeful that those that hear the president's speech tomorrow will know how serious he is. This president knows how serious the challenge is, knows it's got to be solved globally, knows that the key is going to be the development of low-carbon technologies around the world, and is very committed to working toward that end. We know we've got more work to do, and it's going to take real leadership from the U.S.
Do you think that his feelings are shared on Capitol Hill on the Republican side?
Let me say, I think that overall there's a wide variety of knowledge throughout Capitol Hill on both the Republican and the Democratic side. You know, this, Tom, is a major environmental issue. The science is very important. It is a major economic issue, and it's a major political issue. And sometimes people forget that it's all three, and they just get caught up in the politics.
Prime Minister Blair, you've been in favor of an international framework for setting goals and policies. What's the enforcement mechanism?
I think the most important thing to realize is that now there is a consensus that global warming is a huge challenge. There is a consensus that we need an international agreement to supersede Kyoto. There is a consensus that at the heart of that, there should be a substantial reduction in emissions. I mean, I think the really difficult question, which is why actually I welcome the meeting the President's having, is that the problem is really now very simple to describe, at least. And it's this: how do you get a global framework that incentivizes the development of the technology to reduce emissions? How do you get such a global framework that includes America, but also China and India? In other words, the major developing countries. And I do think, you know, in the end with this, it's sometimes very convenient to kind of say, well, you know, if only America simply showed the political will. I mean, the political will is, of course, necessary. I think that will is now there. But there is also the task of constructing that framework so that as China, I think, now has exceeded America in the amount of emissions, and in time, India, of course, with its population, will be a major emitter, already is actually, but even more so. The question is, how do you get a framework that has obligations in it that are fair but differentiated and allow us really to deal with this problem? And one other thing I think is important here, which is that sometimes people say you can't grow your economy and take action on the environment at the same time. We actually will meet our Kyoto targets in the UK. We've reduced greenhouse gas emissions by around about 20%, and we've grown our economy at the same time. So it can actually be done.
Is there a model in the world for that framework? Is the IAEA the kind of model that you're thinking of, or do we have to create a new paradigm and involve the private sector as well as the public sector in that framework?
I think that is the issue, really, because I think you will need a new framework, and it's got to be one that incentivizes the private sector. I mean, if you, when President Clinton had the major CEOs on stage from many of the big companies in the US, it is fantastic that they are taking the action they're taking, and they should really be applauded for it. But in the end, for all of the business around the world, once you create a framework in which it's clear there are going to be market incentives and mechanisms which make it worth their while commercially to research the new technology and develop it, that is when you will really get this deal done. And we've got to find a way of putting a deal together that allows China to grow and deal with the poverty it still has, and India, but grow in a sustainable way. What you can't have is a situation where we carry on thinking, you know, each and every country may take its own initiatives, but you don't have an overall framework within which this thing can be put together. And I would say it's I would say that is the urgent task for this next year's G8. You know, the last G8, we finally got everyone to agree, right, this is a big problem, a big challenge, and we want a global deal, and we want a reduction in emissions at the heart of it. What we've got to do this year is to be able to describe the framework within which that will happen that will include all the major emitters of the world.
Madam Prime Minister, Norway has been on the cutting edge of this issue for some time. Thank you very much to your leadership while you were there. Are there examples for us from Norway that can be expanded to a global basis in terms of the politics and the impact of what you did?
Well, let me first say that I agree fully to what has been said just now about the importance of the private sector and the importance of incentives, the importance of driving technological change. I'm a technology optimist. And it's going to be an important part of the solutions. But on Monday, Alcoa represented industries speaking in the United Nations in the mitigation plenary. What did he say? He said, we need clear, enforced global policies. And we need fair, effective, and binding international commitments. That was the message from industry on Monday. Because if they get that, the drive towards doing what is right will be there. And they will be able to grow, they will be able to invest, and they will be able to do the right thing towards clean energy, renewable energy, energy efficiency, everything that we're speaking about. Now, when I had led the Commission on Environment and Development back in the 80s, of course, I was focused on what can we do at home in Norway, an oil-producing country. So one important issue, which was politically difficult, was we have to have a CO2 tax on the Norwegian continental shelf, on the oil industry itself. And, you know, it came as a shock to the rest of the world, especially all producing countries couldn't believe it was possible to undermine your own industry in this way. But did we? No, we haven't undermined it. The Norwegian oil industry and gas industry is prospering, but we have led down the reductions from the Norwegian continental shelf to one-third of the world average and to half, Tony, of what's on the British and the Danish sectors. But, you know, it has been driven by political decisions and by working with the private sector. They didn't like the CO2 tax, but they knew it was there to stay, and they acted. And they are today very proud of what they have achieved. Now we do carbon capture in the North Sea, deep, 1,000 meters down, to take away the CO2 emissions from the Sleipner field. We are doing it in the future now with a big gas-based power plant that will have a complete carbon capture and storage to it. That's cutting-edge technology, but we are sure it will be able to be done.
Prime Minister Zenawi, in your country, under your leadership, you're having breathtaking success with organic farming and retooling agriculture in northeastern Africa. But at some point, in Ethiopia and all the developing countries, there will be an appetite for what the rest of the industrialized world has in terms of consumer goods and automobiles and vehicles and so on. Is that the next stage of your development in terms of global climate, trying to bring your country online and consumer goods in a way that is also environmentally responsible? Or do you get overwhelmed by the popular demand for all the electrical consuming appliances that are out there?
Well, in a way, the only realistic option for Africa is to grow in a carbon-neutral fashion. Many people, when they discuss global warming and climate change, they discuss it from the point of view of the people who have polluted the environment, who are responsible for 80% of the pollution. But there is an African perspective. The African perspective is this. Africa contributed nothing to global warming because it failed to develop the way the rest of the world developed. Second, the impact of global warming is going to be more devastating in Africa than elsewhere in the world. And this for two reasons. First, the global warming is going to expand the Sahara Desert much towards the south. You are going to have more intense droughts covering a larger part of the continent than we have ever seen. And related to it, Africa's capacity to cope with climate change is very weak. And therefore, climate change and global warming could push the fragile economies and societies of Africa beyond the precipice.
When African leaders get together, however, where, with all the challenges on their agenda, where does global climate change fit on that agenda in terms of their priorities when you meet with the leaders of other countries in sub-Saharan Africa, for example?
We've been slow to understand the ramifications of global warming, but we are catching up. And because we are catching up, we have recognized that global warming could be, next to colonialism and slavery, another of those shocks that could affect the future of the continent, and we have to change. And we have the possibilities to change. I'll give you two examples. The fact that biofuels are now becoming more popular in your countries means that our agriculture does not have to be depressed by the subsidies that you pay to your farmers, because there will be enough market for all of us. In fact, in the short run, there has been an increase in global cereal prices. Over time, as more and more of this is shifted towards biofuels, it will open up new markets for agriculture, including our agriculture. Africa has the potential to grow in a green fashion. I'll give you two examples, Ethiopia and Congo. These two countries alone can generate enough electricity from hydropower to electrify the whole of the continent. So if we move in a green fashion, generate electricity from hydropower, geothermal power, and so on and so forth, and use biofuels for our transport, we can grow without polluting the environment with some assistance from the developed countries.
Mr. Secretary, any discussion about global climate change always comes very swiftly back to China. It has the greatest challenge in the world. You spend a lot of time in that country. It's my very strong impression from my conversation with Chinese leaders, they now get it. And they're not just concerned about it, they're anxious about their future and how they deal with it. But they're dealing with such a critical mass in terms of population explosion and the needs of their economy. It really is a race about whether they can achieve it in the 20th century or the 21st century. When you go to China, what has startled you most of all in terms of the challenges that are ahead of them?
Well, they've got, Tom, you've got it. Their leaders clearly understand the magnitude of the problem and are striving to deal with it. Their people care greatly about this. I mean, the environmental issues they face go well beyond global warming. It's very interesting. The last trip I took to China, I went to the Qinghai Tibetan Plateau because this is an area which is very important to them as for environmental reasons. And their senior official with responsibility for global for climate change was there, as was the head of the NSF. And you know, they've got this huge lake that's slowly drying up. This is the source of, you know, the seven big rivers that this plateau that nurture Asia. And what their scientists told me was that the temperature is rising 1 degree per annum, and that the glacier there, and this is the highest landmass in the world, it goes right up to the Himalayas on the Indian border. The glaciers are melting. They'll be gone in 40 or 50 years. And that, which I had not understood before, that this is really the source of the jet streams. And so the weather patterns all over the world are changing. So they understand the problem. But so much of issues they're dealing with are issues we see in other parts of the economy. They've grown so fast that the risk to China and the rest of the world is that they won't be able to have reform go quickly enough, and they won't be able they've got a legal system, a regulatory system, an enforcement system that isn't where it should be yet, that government leaders just can't set policies in Beijing and have them immediately implemented. They've got strong provincial leadership. And so the same challenges you see when it's in product safety or with capital markets, you also see in the environmental area. But they are they're striving to make progress, and we're doing everything we can to help them.
When we engage with them in trade negotiations and want to put the environment on the table, are they receptive to that?
Well, let me say this, that with the strategic economic dialogue, what we're focused on, what I'm focused on, is several things. And I was really taken with Prime Minister Blair's point about technology, which I strongly agree with. And the solution for the world is going to have to be how do we get the right market signals to have the private sector develop the technology we're going to need to avoid the worst outcomes. Now, as I look at the developing nations, you know, the positive side, I'm also a glass half full person. The positive side, huge advances in technology. And we have technologies today available to us that weren't available when we were going through our development phase. So the developing countries have the opportunity, by adopting these technologies, to leapfrog much of what we've gone through in some of our bad infrastructure. So to me, the first thing when I talk about trade is I say it is economically and morally indefensible to have tariffs on any environmental goods and services. I mean, what's wrong with this picture that we've got clean technologies that are needed around the world and there are tariffs? So there shouldn't be tariffs there. So that's one thing we deal with. Another thing we're talking with China, and I'm very hopeful we'll have a bilateral agreement here, is sustainable logging. Because they outlawed commercial logging in 98. They're the biggest importer of logs and from tropical forests. We in the U.S. are the biggest importer of manufactured wood products. Together, working on sustainable logging would be very important. And then the other thing on the trade area, which we talk about, you know, the man in the street, I think, is more concerned about just the dirty air and SO2 and nitrogen oxide than even carbon emissions. And we've had some experience in the U.S. with cap and trade to help regulate sulfur dioxide, and so we're working with the Chinese and putting some things in place for there. But again, I believe that the strategic economic dialogue we have with China, one of the big focuses is the environment, clean coal technology, carbon capture, carbon sequestration. As everyone has said, the power sector is the most important to get our arms around, and clean coal technology is going to be key there.
Prime Minister Blair, in your country, Nicholas Stern issued what a lot of people saw as an alarming report about the economic consequences of global climate change, and conservative publications in this country seized on it as a Chicken Little publication, The Sky is Falling, that they believe that the Stern report exaggerated the consequences too much, and it gave them a certain political platform. Did you agree with the Stern report?
Well, I commissioned it and published it, so it would have been a bit difficult to dissociate myself from it. And no, I think, but fortunately I didn't need to, because I totally agree with it. And I would only say, for those people that have resisted this argument about climate change, I mean, I think, frankly, as the evidence has accumulated, their position has been exposed as being wrong. And what's more, I'd say in no other field of policy, if the consequences of a particular challenge were so momentous, would we not, at least as a precautionary principle, operate to deal with the issue? And so for me, this is now moved way beyond whether it's a good idea to have a new framework or not. We've got to have one. And I think, you know, the thing really is this. What we require is you've got to have some form of global deal on this, because everybody's got to know that if they're going to take tough action, and some of these choices are difficult, then everybody's in the deal. Now, how you make that deal work between America, China, India, and I'm just taking those, obviously everyone's got to be in it, but, you know, the reality is it's no use this if you
those,
don't...
Those are the big exhaust pipes.
Exactly so. And, you know, if I was told just before I left office, and sometimes your civil service give you these interesting facts. Sometimes the facts you prefer not to know, but this was in this particular case. What they said to me is, if the whole of the UK shut down, then within 2 years, the growth in emissions in China would make up the difference. So, you know, unless you have the global deal, it's not going to work. Secondly, in that global deal, you've got to incentivize the development of the technology. And as has been said by other panelists already, there are the technologies now. Whether it's fuel cell, carbon storage is immensely important. You know, there are going to be coal-fired power stations, but how we deal with carbon storage and clean coal, I don't want to offend anyone here, but I do think the issue of nuclear power has to go back on the agenda again. I think if we're sensible about it, we've got to realise that too has a part to play. And the final bit of it is we've got to make it easier for individuals to play their part. Look, I mean, it's, you know, when you're British, you're always in search of good weather, and it's been fantastic in New York this week, and the problem with global warming is you feel guilty about enjoying it. And there's an element of this where ordinary people want to make their contribution. Now, one of the things when President Clinton was talking about what was happening in California, for example, in the UK now, you can opt to get your electricity from renewable sources. You know, so that you've got incentives on both the energy companies and the consumers. There are lots of things we can do to incentivize good behavior by consumers. Most ordinary people want to make a contribution to this. So I think you've got to look at this at the macro level and at the micro. You've got to have your global framework in place with the obligations and a framework that involves all the major emitters. You've got then to use the technology that's developed and share it with countries. Now, countries like Mellish's, well, you know, they, when they grow, and he's growing, I think he was telling me, which is great for his country, 10% a year the last 4 years. But, you know, when they're building the power stations, if we gave them access to our technology and best scientific advance, we could help that development happen in a more sustainable way. And then the final thing is, you've got to empower the ordinary person, the consumer, to play their part in it. And, you know, I don't think this is immensely difficult to describe now, but I think it is really urgent to do, and I think we've got the opportunity, actually, this year in the meetings that are coming up, at least to set out a clear direction so that we know we will get that post-Kyoto framework, and for the first time, everybody will be involved in acting on it.
How do you reintroduce the idea of proportion into a consumer society?
Proportion, as in the sense of you're going to have to consume less.
How much is too much? How many cars? How large is the house? How much? How many appliances? How many things you have to have? How many private airplanes we have in America now soaring across the country, throwing off CO2 at an astonishing rate?
The great danger when you leave office is you get to buy
a private airplane.
Well, you do that too. but if you're not careful, you cease to be a practicing politician and become a practicing visionary, divorced from the realities of ordinary politics. And then you start telling your people who are still in office, you know, how to go and lose an election. So I think, you see, there's been a debate actually over in my country about, you know, flying and the emissions from airlines and so on. This is what I think. I think the reason why you need this global mechanism that incentivizes the development of the science and technology is that the brutal reality is this. You're not going to stop people consuming or taking flights, and you're not going to stop China dealing with the hundreds of millions of people that are still in poverty. And, I mean, Mellish was too diplomatic to say this earlier, but the truth of the matter is, in any conversation with African leaders, they do care desperately about their development being sustainable. But if you've got people, you know, literally without even the very basic necessities in life, the first thing you've got to do is you've got to provide economic growth for them. So the reason why I think it is so important that we have these mechanisms that develop the science and technology as fast as possible is that if we go out to the world and say, you know, here's the deal, we can save the environment, but you've got to stop consuming, you're going to lose that debate. What you can say to people is, here are a series of choices that you can make. Some of those choices will involve damaging the environment, but some of those choices, consistent with a decent standard of living, will be helpful for the environment. And I think that's, in the end, the practical and sensible way to do it.
Prime Minister Mellish, what is the technology that you most desperately need now in Ethiopia that would help you with the issue of climate change?
two things, really. First, we want to use biofuels for local consumption. And also, we want to export biofuels to the developed world. Now, if the developed world...
What product would grow best? Would it be switchgrass, or would it be...
It could be sugar.
Sugarcane.
Sugarcane for ethanol, and Jatropha for diesel. Now, in order for us to use these fuels, the cars that you manufacture should be such that we can run these cars on biofuel. If the United States were to decide tomorrow that all cars should be fuel flex, then the only cars that come to our country would also be fuel flex, because you determine the characters of global market, and then we would be able to use our sugar to cover our transport requirements. The same thing with diesel. So we want the developed world to, as it were, put the standards for us to be able to use the technology. Second, we in the past have not been able to use our enormous hydropower and geothermal power because the environmental concern then was that dams were very bad because there would be some people who would be resettled and so on and so forth. If we had the resources, as I said earlier on, we could generate electricity ourselves, and the Democratic Republic of Congo could generate enough electricity for the whole of the continent from hydropower. So we need the money. Where do we get the money? The money is being generated by people such as Prime Minister Blair through development assistance programs to Africa. But this can only go so far. The money has to come from the cap and trade mechanism. We have to have access to the carbon trade as a matter of right. We did not pollute. We are being punished because of what you did, and we deserve the right to sell carbon emissions to you so that we can use the money to promote green development in our countries.
Hank, how would you like the assignment if the President said to you, well, Mr. Paulson, you now get to go to Iowa, Kansas, Minnesota, South and North Dakota and tell the corn farmers that we're going to start buying sugar cane from Ethiopia and making our biofuels out of that because we know it is more efficient. Would you like that assignment?
Yeah, that's why I'm not a politician. I've never run for office, and I'm never going to have to run for office because that's a tall order. But I do react very positively to what the Prime Minister said about alternative fuels in the automotive sector and flex fuels, because I would say one of the things that the President proposed, which was addressing the automotive sector in the U.S. with a program which would reduce gasoline consumption by 20% in 10 years, and with heavy reliance on not only conservation but on alternative fuels and ethanol, cellulosic ethanol, etc. And again, it was, my projection would be that as this program takes off. And I'm very optimistic, like a number of other panelists here, about technology and how close we are in a number of areas, close in cellular, close with hydrogen, with plug-in hybrids, and close with cellulosic ethanol, that demand would be so great for 35 billion gallons that we would want and need ethanol from many sources. Now, Congress hasn't enacted this program, and we'd prefer to get legislation, but the President is moving forward, that's the EPA to achieve the same result using a regulatory measure. So again, I think that if trade, I believe, is a big part of the answer. I very much agree with Prime Minister Blair that we need economic development, we need jobs, we need growth. And when I think about economic development, I think one of the biggest things that can be done would be a successful Doha round for everything. And because it is not something that is going to run counter to what we're trying to do here, it will be helpful. And I believe if we think boldly that it won't come to having to tell the farmers in Iowa we want to import ethanol from other countries. We'll need to, because the demand will be so big.
Prime Minister, Madam Prime Minister, at the Democratic debate last night in Hanover, New Hampshire, of the candidates, on stage, all but one of them took nuclear power off the table, so to speak, as a means of dealing with global climate change. And in that response, it was even conditioned. Are we going to have to get over our fear of nuclear power as a source of domestic electricity?
Well, you know, I have always felt that even as we work on the commission, this was a very difficult issue to have 22 people from around the world agree on. Because, in fact, the storage systems for and the end game of nuclear use of nuclear energy is still not completely safe. It's not ideal. But none of our except really clean energy are without risks. So, in a sense, I believe that nuclear energy is going to stay as part of the total energy mix. However, as we listen to Ethiopia speaking, it is clear that, you know, in Africa, to be able to grow their economy sustainably and to take care of basic humanitarian needs, they need energy, clean energy. They need an energy pattern that is sustainable. And it's an important part of what the world needs to focus on as we look at how to take care of avoiding even worse climate effects on that continent and to have development happening. So I think what he was explaining is exactly the kind of thing that we need to be supporting. And I think, you know, I was very glad to hear you say, you know, we need a cap and trade system. You have to have a price on carbon. You have to, globally, whether it is done by taxes, which, you know, if it were politically feasible to do so, that would be the simplest system. If it's not feasible everywhere, well, then we need a cap and trade system. And that will give resources and financing opportunities, market mechanisms that can help developing countries avoid going through our polluting stages. It's happening already in China. There is a clean development mechanism. It is in no way ideal. It doesn't work as it should. But it illustrates that we are already starting to have mechanisms of a market nature that can help force or inspire development in the right direction. So carbon today has a price in China because of the clean development mechanism. It's too low. It's not sufficient. You have, as we heard, provinces that are not doing it. But if we get a global deal, including USA and China, then we can move in that same direction based on our experiences already.
Well, I've been personal witness to the extraordinary advances that they've made. 10 years ago, I was at a chemical plant. I dare say I wasn't there very long for reasons that are about to be clear to you, about 150 miles southwest of Shanghai. It was spewing what you could only call granitic air out of the pipes. And the air monitoring system for two camels and three other cows that they had staked out outside. And when they began to collapse, then they began to shut down the plant. That was their air monitoring system at the time. So we made a very quick trip to that plant and then made a very quick exit from it, so that they have made great advances. They're no longer using not canaries in the coal mine, but camels staked out in the yard. Prime Minister Blair, have you been surprised by the extent to which the private sector has responded to the challenges of global climate change, seeing it as an economic opportunity?
I mean, I've been really heartened by it, but less surprised in a way, because I think they're also responding to what their own consumers and also their own employees are doing. And I think for a lot of the private sector today, what they're actually looking for now is a clear sense of direction from the international community, because I think the will is there, really. And as you know, as was just being said, I mean, the clean development mechanism, but look, the whole point about this is you've got to create a system. And for example, in Europe, you now have the emissions trading system, which is just beginning and getting off the ground. And the purpose of this, and we've now set some very ambitious targets on the reduction in emissions. The purpose is to create a carbon price and a carbon market. And actually that can then generate money, which can be used for the clean development mechanism and allow then the investment by countries that need to grow but are poor in sustainable technology and in sustainable development. And for the private sector, this is, you know, this is something they are, I think, absolutely up for doing. But they need to know, obviously, that they're operating as far as possible on a level playing field, and that someone's not going to get a competitive advantage by poor environmental practice. And so I think you're at a point now where the business community internationally, curiously, I think is ahead of the politics and is saying to political leaders, now is the moment. You know, if you give us the direction, you give us the framework, we will get behind this and invest in it. And I think what is remarkable is that you look at some of the leading power companies, some of whom have been represented here today, in the US, talking a language that I think, you know, would have been the language of NGOs a few years back, but is the language of conventional business wisdom. And I just think we've got to get behind that and really push it and make sure that the will that's there in the business community is then, you know, allowed to develop in the way they want, because business will take this far faster and further than governments if they get the right mechanism to do so, in my view.
Hank, does the business community need more incentives in this area, economic incentives?
There's no doubt that the Prime Minister is right, that the business community is ahead of government around the world, that they would like more certainty, that the level playing field is right, because let's not forget that a ton of carbon emitted from the China or India is just as harmful as one from the UK or Norway, and that if, when we set the incentives, if one country does something to drive industry overseas, it may not be displacing a ton. You may have 2 tons, because the practices may not be as clean. So again, I think that what the private sector has done is key, and I think market mechanisms and signals are, and I think how each country, because I think the trick is really this. It is impossible to solve this without technology development. It is impossible to solve this without engaging globally. And that's why I think this meeting in Washington is just so absolutely critical. We just can't sweep under the rug that this, we've got to look at this globally. And then as countries set their targets, they're going to need national strategies to get there. And the national strategies are going to have to be coordinated, but they can't be identical, because different countries have different economies or different levels of development. They have different energy profiles. And so this is a major undertaking. And again, we need to do it in a way in which if politicians are going to be elected, and if we're going to continue to have the capacity to solve the problem, we're going to need to continue to have economic growth. It's just going to be sustainable economic growth. And so this is very important. It's not easy. And as I said before, there's a huge scientific really predicate that if we don't do things today, we're not going to be able to avoid the possibility of some very, very bad outcomes 30 or 40 years from now. So we've got to get together. I think people understand that. So there's a political imperative, but the politics of this are different than, you know, are very different than in some cases where the science would take you, and there's a big energy security component and a big economic component, and they all have to be balanced.
Let's see if we can get some conclusions on that very appropriate and concluding point. Let me ask each of you to think how you would design an international framework, whether you would put it in existing agencies, create a new agency, and what would be the enforcement mechanisms that you would use. Madam Prime Minister, let's begin with you.
I think we should build on the experiences we already have. And but really also develop new mechanisms within a future framework that needs to cover all. I go back to what Alcoa was saying on Monday. We have been talking about it really during this panel. Industry needs political signals and long-term ones. And it's not sufficient, really, that each country on its own sets its own targets without any global connection. So we do need the broad framework that we have been speaking about in this panel. But we need a carbon market, a price on carbon, and we need to be aware, in addition to what we have been speaking about here, the adaptation side, because many countries have climate tragedies already now. Low, you know, sea level, small island states, flooding, hurricanes that are hitting. And so the money can be mobilized through the system that we make in the international framework with sufficient mechanisms to deal with both adaptation and mitigation.
And what would work in Africa for you, Mr. Prime Minister?
The key thing for us is the cap and trade mechanism. The cap and trade mechanism is ultimately about allocation of property rights. There is a scarce resource here, which is the amount of pollution that the earth can take. And that is going to be divided up among people so that those who need not use it can sell it to those who need it. So ultimately, it's a question of property rights. Now, we are not part of that property allocation at the moment as a continent. We want to be part of it. We are part of this globe physically. We have to have the property right to pollute or to sell our pollution rights to those who cannot but pollute. And we want it as a matter of right. If it is going to be driven by philanthropy, we will not get enough money to have clean development. So we give us the access to the carbon trade as a matter of right, as a matter of property right.
Prime Minister Blair, putting on your visionary cap, which you've not taken off, obviously, how do you enforce all of this?
Well, I think the first thing that you need in an international agreement is you need, at the heart of it, a global target for the reduction of emissions. However, then I think you've got to be realistic. You are not going to get, and this is, I totally agree with what Hank was saying here, you're not going to get a global deal that is the same strategy operating in every country. So I think what you will end up with is a series of different strategies, probably based on cap and trade, and then a linking mechanism, right, so that you can trade across the different emission systems. I think thirdly, you will then need to, through a better clean development mechanism, generate the funding, both for helping countries that are poorer use the technology, and also for actual research in the technology itself. I think that fourthly, you will require a system of technology transfer so that as the technologies are being developed, there is the ability to transfer those technologies across national boundaries to the poorer countries. And I think that you will also, within that, you can have, for example, sector by sector agreements internationally where you take some of the biggest emitting sectors and you actually do a global deal there where maybe you can have something that is very similar right across the world. Here's my final point on this, however. This work is it's what I would call political stroke technical work. In other words, how you construct such a framework and then how you get the politics in the right realistic place is the issue, in my view, of the coming year. And I think the shame of it is, in a way, that political stroke technical work is actually exactly what you want the international community to be doing. And one of the things that I think is still very frustrating about the institutions we have in the international community is you have a problem like this, but you have a big gap between the capability in an interdependent world of the global community to act and the necessity for action. And so I think for the main governments in the world now, the single most important thing is to sit down and try and design that system so that at the G8 this year, as well as agreeing it's a big problem, as well as agreeing that everyone's got to be in the deal, we see the framework, the outline of what a global deal would be, and that would be the international community acting responsibly.
Is that possible, Mr. Paulson?
Well, it just depends on what your expectations are, because if you realize how enormous this challenge is, then you don't expect too much immediately. But it's important. There's great urgency. That's why I, again, believe this get-together in Washington is so important. I believe what the UN is going to be doing in Bali is very, very important. I believe that what the Prime Minister said about global institutions resonates with me, some of the multilateral institutions, because if you're a private sector financial institution, if you don't change with the environment and with the world around you, you cease to exist. That doesn't happen with some of the global institutions, but they're still very important. So I see, when I look at technology, for instance, totally agree with what the Prime Minister says about making it available. I would like to see the World Bank and other multilateral institutions play a role in funding technology and low-cost technology. When I was in Brazil, one of the things that was talked about, there was this plan for some time, which, of course, some of us that are environmentalists cringe about, building a highway through the Amazon. Now, they say that if they were to build a railroad through there, there would be much less of a threat. But it costs, billions of dollars, $3 billion more to build a railroad than a highway. But those are the kinds of things I think the world needs to focus on. And then there will be things that are done by certain groups. One of the things I know that the President Bush worked on with Prime Minister Blair was this global nuclear initiative, where you had the major nuclear powers working to develop safe, proliferation-resistant nuclear power, because nuclear is zero carbon emissions, just like solar or wind or so on. So there are going to need to be things done, but I do believe we're not going to be able to solve this without, which I come back to Prime Minister Blair, without the major economies of the world getting together and working something out. There's just no avoiding that.
Thank you all very much. A reminder to all of you who have been witness to, I think, a far-ranging and eloquent discussion of one of the great challenges of our time, is that you too have a part in all of this. And you'd be surprised that if you go through your own personal life, through your home, your car, and how you conduct yourself, and the values that you impart most of all to the generation coming along, you can have your own very profound impact on how we can do something about global climate change. Thank you all very much for your attention today.
Ladies and gentlemen, the plenary session is now concluded. Your working sessions will begin at 10:30 a.m. Please proceed to your next session. Thank you.